Good morning. We convene today to hear United States against Baker. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Captain Rich Gallagher. Lieutenant Colonel Imogene Jameson and I represent Specialist Demetrius Baker. Arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable are all terms that this court has used to define an abuse of discretion. The military judge's decision to suppress the identification evidence did not even approach the clear error of judgment contemplated by this strict standard. The Army Court, we would submit, had a mere difference of opinion, and they substituted their own judgment for the military judge's sound exercise of judicial discretion. Your Honor, there was nothing arbitrary about the military judge's conclusion that the identification procedures were unnecessarily suggestive. After he...
Counsel, this took place in Germany. The actors were entirely, other than the appellant, were entirely German. Does that have any effect?
No, Your Honor.
It does not. Okay. Do we apply prophylactic rules constructed to ensure against domestic law enforcement abuse to German police operating in Germany?
Your Honor, nothing changes. Military rule of evidence 321 still applies. Your Honor, there was nothing.
Counsel, is rule 321 a prophylactic rule to deal with abuse, or is it a rule designed to ensure the reliability of evidence before a court-martial?
It's a rule, Your Honor, that is there to ensure the reliability of the evidence before a court-martial, and it satisfies the requirements of the Supreme Court's case in United States versus Biggers. Now, it's our view, Your Honors, that the military judge's conclusion that the procedures were unnecessarily suggestive was entirely within his judicial discretion. After he made the findings of fact...
Before you get into that, can you just point out where in his findings and conclusions of law and so on that he analyzes how the photo identification was unnecessarily suggestive and where he balances the weighing of the likelihood of misidentification?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where does that occur?
Your Honor, the military judge in page 3 to 4 of his ruling, page 4 of his ruling, the military judge attributed the Ms. TB's certainty and the accuracy of her identification to the unnecessarily suggestive identification procedures.
Goes through the Biggers factors, but I don't see any analysis of how the factors apply to the suggestive manner of the show-up or how they relate to the substantial likelihood of misidentification. Is there any analysis that I'm missing?
Your Honor, our view is that the military judge did conduct the proper analysis.
But where is that analysis reflected in the findings and the conclusions of law?
Well, Your Honor, first the military judge lays out all his findings of fact, and then he goes through the Biggers factors and the additional factor that this court considered in United States versus Rhodes. For the unnecessarily suggestiveness, the military judge made findings of fact that support that conclusion. One, that before Ms. TB even arrived at the police station, the police told her that they had caught someone that she should take a look at. That Ms. TB presumed that the police had verified the accuracy of her description before they presented her with a single image. And then that identification procedure itself consisted, Your Honors, solely of presenting Ms. TB with a single photographic image of Specialist Baker. Now, as there was also nothing arbitrary about the military judge's conclusions under the first two Biggers factors, that Ms. TB had a minimal opportunity to view the rider and degree of attention to the rider. The Army Court adopted the military judge's findings of fact, reportedly in support of those conclusions. One.
So you think that addresses the relationship between suggestiveness and misidentification? J- just listing the facts and then that takes care of that?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that if the military judge draws a conclusion that the identification procedures were unnecessarily suggestive, under this court's strict standard, we have to look at what findings of fact supported such a conclusion. And here...
But counsel, in this case, the problem is, and I don't mean to interrupt you, Judge Baker, but I think what he may be getting at is that he lists a bunch of facts, right? But even if we were to agree that while he did not explain why it was unnecessarily suggestive, even if we were to agree, fine, it was a show up, we'll take it as a given that it was unnecessarily suggestive, that there still has to be some analysis as to why, in this case, there was a substantial likelihood of misidentification. And you're talking about the facts that the military judge found, but what you're failing to account for are facts that the government asked him to reconsider and to add into his findings, the fact that he didn't. For example, not just that she said that he was wearing biker's clothes, but the precise clothes that he was wearing, et cetera, et cetera. So where on these facts can we say that the military judge's finding that there was a reasonable, substantial likelihood of misidentification wasn't unreasonable?
Well, Your Honor, one critical factor that the military judge considered, as this court did in United States versus Rhodes, was that the government failed to produce conclusive evidence or sufficient evidence regarding the likelihood of other individuals in the area matching the description provided by the
police. You had two police officers say that they asked a bunch of different people and that they saw went all over the place and that the only individual that they were pointed to was this particular individual and that he matched the description that she had given them precisely.
Well, Your Honor, we would disagree that the police officers went all over the place. The police officers went to a location that was in the middle of the location where the incident took place.
And they were pointed and they were pointed in a particular direction by two different groups of people, were they not?
Yes, they were, Your Honor.
And that's where they went.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's where they apprehended the individual, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But it was also critical.
And so we should just disregard all of that.
No, this court absolutely should consider it, Your Honor, as the military judge did. And he said he acknowledged during the motion for reconsideration that it's some evidence. But the military judge also said, and this was well within his judicial discretion, that he would decline to find specific details relayed by the police officers to the two groups in the trail where the trial counsel failed to elicit such facts, Your Honor. That was a sound exercise of judicial discretion. Now, unlike the Army Court, the military judge refused, and properly so, to take Ms. TB's certainty in the accuracy of her identification at face value. The military judge found that certainty was attributable to the highly suggestive identification procedures. There was no emergency here. There was no...
Where does the judge find that, just to be clear?
Well, Your Honor, the judge does not make a specific finding that there was no emergency, but that is clear from the
findings.
Where
does the judge find what you just said, conclude what you just said, which was it was this suggestive photo show up that led to her certainty? In her testimony, she's very clear that she doesn't, when she's in court, she says, I can't remember this today, but she was certain that she, from back then, so she seems pretty credible to me that she is clear when she remembers something and when she does not. But now you're saying it's all based on that one photo?
Your Honor, it's not just based on the photo, but to answer your question, the military judge found at paragraph 4 of page 4 of his ruling that Ms. TB's high level of certainty can partly be attributed to the suggestiveness of both identifications. And critically, and this is where there was more than just the photo, Your Honor, he says, after assuming that the police had verified the accuracy of her description, Ms. TB was shown this image of Specialist Baker. That was another critical factor that we believe well supported the military judge's conclusion.
At trial, who bore the burden?
The government bore the burden, Your Honor.
Government bore the burden of demonstrating reliability.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in this case, then, what is the judge's obligation at that point in terms of what the judge puts on the record? Is the judge required to demonstrate unreliability, or is the judge required to indicate in a situation like this where the judge is excluding the evidence that the government hasn't met its burden?
The military judge is required to do precisely what he did here, Your Honor, and that is hear the evidence, make findings of fact, draw conclusions of law that apply the correct legal principles that are based on those findings of fact. And more specifically, Your Honor, the military judge is required to lay out legal conclusions if this is how the judge is so inclined, that the government has failed to demonstrate the reliability of the identification evidence that it wants to offer at trial.
Get that all out of paragraph 6? Is that what you're relying on for all that?
Your Honor, I'm relying on the entire opinion by the military judge where he...
Where does he say the government hasn't met its burden and all that stuff?
Well, Your Honor, at the end of the military judge's opinion, which is page 4, paragraph 6,
government has not proven by clear and convincing evidence, but that's a conclusion. He isn't not required to put any analysis in there.
Absolutely.
That relates back to the facts.
The judge cannot just make a conclusion without findings of fact. And here the military judge laid out extensive findings of fact that we would support his conclusion.
What I'm stuck on is usually there's facts and then there's analysis of the facts before the conclusion. But this model is facts, conclusion.
You're
missing that linkage between law and fact. And you're finding it, though, by inferring it from the facts. You're saying, and because the government had the burden, and they didn't meet it.
The only thing that we're doing, Your Honor, is we're looking at those findings of fact that the military judge made and seeing if they support the military judge's subsequent legal conclusions. We would submit that they do, Your Honor.
Fair enough.
Counsel, I want to focus specifically on what the military judge did or did not exclude in this case. What specific evidence is excluded?
Is excluded, Your Honor? The evidence excluded by the military judge is evidence of the identification that took place outside of court at the police station, Your Honor. Did the judge
exclude her initial identification, that is, the statement that she gave to the police, that was given to the police in terms of what she initially saw?
No, Your Honor.
And did the judge exclude her second statement when she arrived at the police station and she added additional information?
No, he just...
That's not excluded either. Did the judge exclude any information that either the witnesses on the trail or that the police officers themselves identified in terms of arresting this individual, your client?
No, Your Honor.
So all that... If this court should rule, and I'm not giving any indication one way or another, but if this court should rule that the military judge was correct, all that information could still come into trial if it's otherwise admissible.
Yes, Your Honor. The government still has the ability to put on some identification evidence, just not what happened at the police station with the identification by Ms. TB, and not Ms. TB saying in court, as she did at the motions hearing, that this is the man who
Just as a matter of procedure, the way that a court martial would usually work, right, is that if a witness was led through all the testimony that Judge Efron just described, her description that she had given it initially, the additional detail that she gave when she went to the police station before she looked at the photo of the individual, wouldn't the next logical question that the government would ask the witness, and is that person present in the courtroom today, and she would say yes or no, and they wouldn't be allowed to ask that final question, would they?
In this case, based on the military judge's ruling, no, Your Honor, and nor would they be able to ask the question, and when you were at the police station, did you identify special
And state? So you don't think that would strike the members as somewhat odd?
There would be a gap in the government's case, but that's the product, Your Honor, of the unnecessarily suggestive procedures and the unreliable evidence that the military judge found was present.
What precisely, in your view, was unreliable about the description that she gave? What was the difference between what she described and what appellant actually looked like?
Your Honor, I see that I'm almost out of time.
Counsel, I'm sure you'll be able to answer my question.
Counsel, take the time that you need to answer the question from Judge Ryan, and then we'll see if any of my other colleagues have questions at that point.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the description was, as the military judge described, somewhat accurate. It wasn't perfect. Ms. TB...
Let me ask it a different way. What that she described, okay, was different than what the appellant looked like in the photo. What was different? What was wrong about her description?
Well, Your Honor, there was...
Nothing, right?
There was nothing that was particularly wrong about what she described, but there was certainly an absence of certain details in her description.
Such as?
For example, at the police station, Your Honor, Ms. TB did not provide... I'm on the phone with the police officer. She didn't describe... the eyes, the hair color, the nose, the jaws. She couldn't see the eyes or the hair because that was covered by the helmet and sunglasses.
And she described that he was wearing a helmet and sunglasses and bicycle glasses.
She did, Your Honor. Ms. TB gave a generalized description of the clothing, but she didn't mention that the shirt contained German writing, which Specialist Baker was found with. She didn't mention that there was a stripe going down, black spandex shorts. She just said black shorts. She didn't mention that there were cycling gloves, that there was cycling shoes. Specialist Baker was found with both of those details, Your Honor. So there were certainly things that Ms. TB didn't provide about her assailant that didn't match what Specialist Baker had when he was apprehended.
But not a single detail that she described was inaccurate, was it?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
No.
I have one more question. In Rhodes, you're familiar with Rhodes, at the this court was applying the test we're talking about today and identified in paragraph 11 three factors in balancing suggestiveness with risk of misidentification. And I'll read them to you just in case you don't have them memorized, though I suspect you do because you prepared well. Her description of the offender fit exactly the individual who is apprehended. There is no discrepancies between her description and the physical appearance of the appellant shortly after the crime. And at the time, it is highly unlikely that someone would be walking down the road in a suit and dress shoes. Those are the three factors that this court earlier relied on in the Rhodes case. And putting aside who has the burden at trial, why do those factors apply in this case or not apply in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll take it with
you. And you sort of addressed one of them, which is fit exactly the individual who is apprehended. And if I understood your response to Judge Ryan, the description did fit exactly the individual who is apprehended, but your point is it lacks certain details.
Yes, Your Honor.
It was accurate to the extent it was provided, but is that a fair?
Yes,
I'm
Your
just
Honor.
Trying to.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no discrepancies between her description and the physical appearance of the appellant. That's true, too. Is it not? Accurate, is it not? But your point, again, is, but it lacks certain details.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then why not address this last one? At the time, it was highly unlikely that someone would be walking down the road in a suit and dress shoes. Now, of course, that's not your case. But the point there was that it was the possibility of misidentification was absent because this person was the only person who could possibly be located there.
Yes, Your Honor. So if I may respond to your question.
Yeah.
Just picking up with the last factor there, as this court stated in Rose, that there was highly unlikely that someone would be walking down Royal Road in a suit and dress shoes at 4 a.m. Well, here, context is important. Ms. TP did not describe a cyclist in cycling gear in a residential neighborhood in the middle of the night. She described a cyclist on a recreational trail in Germany on a Saturday afternoon in July. It is not hard to imagine other cyclists resembling the descriptions that Ms. TV provided. Your Honor, the other thing that distinguishes this case from Rhodes is that in Rhodes, the victim was with her assailant for approximately 20 minutes in her bedroom while this assault was taking place. And in this case, Ms. TV really only had one close encounter with her assailant, which, unlike the Army Court, the military judge found lasted a few moments. So we would distinguish the two cases in that manner, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You'll have a further opportunity on rebuttal. Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Major Adam Kazin. I, along with Major Amber Williams, represent the United States in this matter. The Army Corps properly determined that the military judge abused his discretion in suppressing the victim's identification of appellant. The Supreme Court noted in Manson v. Braithwaite, to suppress an identification as unnecessarily suggested, there must be, quote, a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. Short of that point, such evidence is for the jury to weigh. This court echoed the sentiment in United States v. Webb. The military judge failed to heed this standard and was unreasonable in his analysis and his conclusion. And the error that the military judge significantly made was his issues were one of weight, not admissibility. And so he was prejudging the evidence before he looked at whether or not there was a due process violation. And that's what MRE 321 and this line of cases is about, a due process right. And what the courts have identified is that it's an evidentiary right. The issue is whether or not this identification is so unfair and so unreliable that somehow a panel or a jury wouldn't be able to sort through it based on the arguments of counsel and the evidence presented at trial.
So explain to us where, in fact, the abuse of discretion occurs in these findings and conclusions.
Well, what the Army Corps pointed to was that it was a clear and reasonable in this application of the facts to the law. And we begin with the fact that the military judge's findings of fact were.
Where does the Army Corps specifically say that, so we can focus on that?
I apologize. It's in at the bottom of page 3, Your Honor, and I'm looking at the Westlaw. Version of the brief, which is attached to our supplement, our answering supplement. We find the military judge abused his discretion and granted the defense motion to suppress both the photo and in-court identifications of appellee because he, quote, committed a clear error of judgment in the conclusion he reached upon weighing of the relevant factors.
Okay, that's a different phrase, but I understand.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm citing the phrase I used is actually from Knights versus Ellis, which is what the court relied upon. And again, abuse of discretion. Even in an Article 62 appeal, if the military judge unreasonably conducts the analysis, the courts are not, there's certainly deference to the military judge, but that deference does not allow for unreasonable determinations.
In an Article 62 appeal, is the CCA entitled to make their own findings of fact?
They are not, Your Honor.
You still have only an answer on my question, but you can go off and do that if you want, but don't forget.
I'm sorry, I actually forgot your question, Your Honor, so repeat that for me, please.
The question was, show us exactly where and how the judge abused his discretion using his actual findings and conclusion of law rather than just citing Supreme Court cases and saying he didn't do that.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, it's not an issue of citation. It's an issue of analysis. The judge certainly cited the right case law. What the Army Corps identified in the difference of opinion is one is his analysis of the first three vigorous factors. That's where the dispute between the Army Corps and the military judge are. They agreed on the second and third. And the second is that the military judge did not do what the Army Corps did. And what the Army Corps identified is that at some point you have to take the supposedly unnecessarily suggestive identification and take that corrosive effect that it's supposed to have and weigh it against the reliability. The military judge never conducted that analysis. His final page certainly has a conclusory statement, but there's no analysis that supports that statement.
So in this case, we're not going to apply the standard of we assume that the judge knows and applies the law.
Oh, we're certainly going to. And the government's not arguing that the judge is not entitled to the deference that is part of abuse of discretion, Your Honor. The question is whether or not the military judge was unreasonable in his analysis.
But is there a requirement that the judge lay out in writing every part of the thought process or not? Okay, thank you.
I know, Your Honor. But there has to be some key aspects of the analysis that are necessary. And looking at the military judge's findings, the problem is the military judge seemed to not want to analyze the parts of the facts that did not fit his conclusion. And for example, the military judge never addressed the fact that the victim in this case positively identified minute facial features of the accused. When the military judge makes a finding that her identification was somewhat accurate, that's not a finding of fact. That is a value judgment about the facts and evidence. Both the Army Court and the military judge were operating off the same operative facts. There's really no disagreement as to the sequence of events. Where there's disagreement over is the value of those facts as it applies to the legal analysis. And the military judge simply didn't really make a judgment about it. He simply disregarded the facts that did not fit a particular conclusion. In this case, when the military judge says that they were somewhat accurate, it's a little weird because the description changes throughout his paragraph. At first, the military judge describes, and I'm quoting here, in the first sentence, he says he gave a somewhat accurate description of the accused when he was apprehended, muscular black male with a slight mustache and wearing bicycle attire. And two sentences later, he says basically the accused is a black male wearing bicycle attire riding along the trail. Somewhere in there, the mustache that she identified disappeared. And also, the military judge states that there was, quote, no evidence presented at the motions hearing regarding the similarity between the other descriptions and the actual description of the accused. The problem with that is that that's actually not a statement about what happened on the day of the offense. That's a statement of what happened at the motions hearing.
So is the argument here that the judge is clearly erroneous in his findings of fact?
Well, that statement, Your Honor, it's not clear because it's not a finding of fact about as to what happened the day of the assault. It's a finding of what happened the day of the motions hearing. And the record of 44, the officers testified that the gap in the tooth and the mustache matched the description of the guy they had downstairs. Now, the military judge can do with that fact, he can do two things with that fact, that evidence. He can either state in his record that he doesn't believe that evidence, that he disregarded it because he didn't believe Officer Gress' credibility determination, or he could state that the weight of other evidence somehow overwhelmed it. But what the military judge is not free to do is to pretend that the evidence wasn't submitted. He must account for it. And so that statement, which is in his conclusions of law, whether we call it a finding of fact and do it as a clear error or a conclusion of law as part of his analysis, and we de novo, it's untrue because there was a specific testimony at trial that said that when Ms. TB identified the gap in the tooth and the mustache, neither of which can be seen in the photograph, and one of which was she identified before the photograph was ever given, those matched the guy they had downstairs, which was appellant. So those facts just didn't play into the analysis at all.
We've gotten off from some of the questions. I want to make sure first that Judge Baker got the answer to his question, and then Judge Erdman had a question, so we can return to that.
I'd like to follow up on the findings of fact issue between the military judge and the CCA. Under the opportunity to view section in the CCA decision, I understand your argument that what appears to be findings of fact in the CCA opinion are interpretations of an agreed-upon set of facts, and the parties can certainly argue about that, but there's one fact in there where the CCA held that Ms. TB had a concentrated period of at least 1 or 2 minutes to view the rider's face. Where do we find that in the military judge's findings?
Well, the military judge, he used the term a moment.
Well, now, there's a difference between a moment and 2 or 3 minutes, isn't there?
Yes, Ron, and I think that you have to look at that statement that they made in the context of the sentences that came before and that came after. I agree that no one at any point had a specific, this is the number of minutes, this is the number of time. The term 1 to 2 minutes was a descriptive of enough opportunity for the victim to identify particular facial features. And if you look at the next sentence that comes right after that, the point they were making was she was able to observe his face closely enough to remember a gap in his teeth and a mustache.
Well, but that's all based on the fact,
yes, Your Honor,
that the CCA felt that she had 1 to 2 minutes of viewing the face.
Well, I think that the identification of the gap in the tooth, even the military judge stated that was part of her description. So that is based out of facts that were pulled out of the military judge's findings. The amount of time was not central to the CCA's opinion, Your Honor.
Well, I'm not talking about whether it was central or not. I'm asking whether or not that finding was in the military judge's finding.
There was no specific reference to the amount of time, Your Honor.
You would agree that if it wasn't a fact found by the judge, it's off the table. The CCA can't come and create new facts. Without conceding that is a new fact.
Unless clearly erroneous. They can analyze facts that are clearly erroneous. And the government does...
And so stipulate that the 1 to 2 minutes is a fact that's not derived from the record or from the judge's findings.
If we excise that line from the CCA's opinion, it changes nothing. Because, like I said, looking at the sentences before and the sentences after, the point that the CCA was making was that when the accused grabbed Ms. TB and was close enough to touch her, and she was close enough to hear that he spoke English, she was able to identify particular features of his face. And where we get into why that plays in the analysis is that if we look at the picture at the appellate exhibit that's submitted, you can't see a gap in his teeth, and you can't see a mustache from that wide open view. And she identified those aspects of his facial features prior to any photo being showed to her or her being able to see his face close up.
And, well, let's move on to the degree of attention. Where do we find in the military judge's findings that Ms. TB focused significant attention on the rider?
Well, and this comes from the judge's findings, Your Honor. If you look at his facts from pages 1 and 2, he refers to the rider. And the military judge refers to the same rider on each of the occasions that Ms. TB viewed him. So the military judge's own findings said that it was the same rider. She said,
Well, no, the significant attention to the rider. Where do we find that?
Well, again, the significant attention...
And nobody's arguing it's a different rider.
Well, the distinction between what the judge said was minimal and CCA determined as significant, that's not a finding of fact, Your Honor. That's an opinion about what the evidence is worth. That's a weight question. And so when the military judge makes that finding, he's not taking just facts. He's taking his facts and he's making a judgment, a value judgment about those facts. And what the CCA said is we look at these same facts, we look at all these opportunities that she had to see him, the 5 occasions, and the degree of specificity in which she was accurately identifying him and saying that is significant attention. Even the military judge's findings said that she looked at him 5 different times, that she noticed him again and again and again. So it's not inconsistent with the military judge's findings. What's different between the CCA and the military judge is the value, the weight that they assigned to those particular facts.
It's how they interpreted the facts.
How they value the facts. I think interpreted...
And don't we give deference to the military judge's interpretation of the facts unless those findings are clearly erroneous?
Well,
and here, the CCA shouldn't be making facts that were not found, and certainly not facts that seem to contradict the military judge did.
I think what this court said in Casio is there's a distinction between what we call as facts as things, events, deeds, or circumstances that actually exist versus legal effect, consequence, or interpretation. And so just military judges saying, I think that this is worth, that her 5 times looking at it is worth very little, is not a finding of fact that is under the clear error standard. It is him taking the facts and making a judgment based on the legal analysis, because the law tells us what rank the evidence goes in. And so the military judge simply gave those facts short shrift. They said, I think it's not worth much. When the CCA looked at the exact same facts and said, these facts, under the legal analysis, are worth a lot more.
Why aren't those historical facts? That is, the degree to which the individual had an opportunity to make an accurate, to take an accurate view. Why isn't that a historical fact as opposed to an opinion?
Well, because
I understand the opinion in terms of how you would apply those 5 instances and then say this did or did not add to the reliability determination. But in terms of the actual ability, isn't that an historical fact?
I think it moves, the historical fact is the sequence of events, Your Honor, but once two people can look at this and say, okay, she had a significant opportunity to look at him 5 times, that's one argument. And then there's the defense argument of, well, that's not enough time at all. And what the Supreme Court has said is that's the customary grist for the jury mill, that just because both sides have different arguments about the weight of the evidence, we're not going to, admissibility does not... based on the weight of the evidence. And so with the military judge, when you come to that conclusion of whether or not there was a significant amount of time to view the appellant, there's one aspect of it is historical facts, but when you start moving into the significance of those facts as they apply to the legal analysis, you're no longer talking about historical facts. You're now judging those facts. And so with the military, again, the difference between the CCA and the military judge is the same facts, and the military judge just didn't see those facts as significant. At the same time, the military judge also tended to narrow. He continually described it as a black male on a bicycle, black male on a bicycle. Whereas the evidence before him, even the evidence that the military judge found in his own findings of fact, the description was much more detailed than that. The description discussed, and the military judge found this on reconsideration, that she did describe his clothing, black pants and a white shirt, that it was bicycle attire, that he was wearing a helmet and sunglasses. And the sunglasses, there was a lot of dispute over the sunglasses, whether they were dark or not. This court has a picture of the sunglasses before.
And which facts did the military judge expressly say he was not going to regard, give any weight to?
Well, the problem is that he didn't, Your Honor. He just didn't talk about them. And that's the problem, is that the military judge, when balancing, when the military says no evidence was presented that there was a match between the description and the accused, that's not a finding of fact as to what happened that day. The military judge is claiming that something happened at trial that didn't happen. There was a witness that testified to it. And again, the military judge has choices. The military judge had said, I find Officer Gress to be completely incredible. I don't believe him. I've made a credible determination. There's not much the government can do with that, because that's the military judge.
Is there any indication that he didn't give full credibility to the testimony of the officer?
There's parts of the findings of fact that must come from Officer Gress's testimony.
Right.
The problem is that, again, he made a clear statement that no evidence was presented. And so, the court has to do something with that. Appellate courts, even on Article 62 appeal, are allowed to look at the evidence of record and say, well, actually, this did in fact happen, and make a judgment as to whether or not the military judge, disregarding that fact, both in his findings of fact and his conclusions of law, it was clearly unreasonable. And that's that third prong under Ellis of, when the court said, look, his findings of fact that he actually put in there, we agree with.
Counsel, did the military judge ever explain why he denied the government's motion for reconsideration, or, and specifically its request that he add in additional findings of fact?
Actually, at one point, Your Honor, at page 108, they're arguing about the bicycle, and the military judge says, you understand, I don't have a transcript when I do this. He says, I quote, I make findings that are essential to my conclusion.
And on page 150, when he just says, Government, I have considered your motion for reconsideration, I'm denying your motion for reconsideration, period. Is there more that I've missed?
No, Your Honor.
So on page 4 of his findings of fact and conclusions of law, the end of paragraph 3, when he says, no evidence was presented as to the likelihood of other black males riding their bikes on the trail. Was that an accurate statement, an accurate finding of fact or conclusion in light of the additional facts that were presented at trial about the fact that two different groups of people had pointed to this individual and that he was the only person matching that description that was found on the bike trail?
The problem we run into, Your Honor, is that the military judge he made additional findings of fact, and he seemed to agree with those two statements from the government, but he never amended the written findings, so he kind of never explain how that last sentence fits in.
Right. I guess putting it a different way, we can call it that. You can label it as, you know, his conclusion was clearly unreasonable, or I can ask it a different way. Are findings of fact clearly erroneous if they're missing essential facts? Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, if there are critical facts that are presented, and if the military judge doesn't say, these facts I'm not going to credit because the source is incredible, but yet he fails to put them in and fails to look at them when coming to his legal conclusion. Is that an error that we can consider?
It is, Your Honor, because if there are essential facts that are necessary to legal analysis are missing, the courts, and this is the same, I mean, it's no different from Article 62 appeal than it is a 66 appeal reviewing a legal matter, is that the court can look to the evidence presented at the hearing and say, well, the judge completely missed a particular set of facts that are necessary to our legal analysis, and we look at the evidence that's in the record. The judge just doesn't get the deference that is part of an abuse of discretion review when he completely misses something like that.
Is the difference here between the military judge's opinion and the CCA opinion, is it a difference where reasonable minds could differ, or is the military judge's opinion so far off the mark that it's completely arbitrary and we shouldn't give it any credit?
It's closer to the latter, Your Honor, because the military judge didn't do the legal analysis necessary for purposes of admissibility.
And that's despite the fact that the CCA found that the findings weren't clearly erroneous and the legal principles were correct.
Well, it's where that third prong under Ellis comes in, Your Honor, because if the military judge, again, finds facts that the court doesn't have a problem with and the government doesn't really have a problem with as far as what's in there, and the military judge cites the correct case law, that's not the end of the analysis by an appellate court. I mean, the court also looks and says, well, you kind of got half of it right. And the problem is that you never actually balanced the supposedly corrosive effect on the identification. The military judge never explained how it was possible that the picture could influence Mrs. TB's identification. I mean, the picture could not possibly have influenced her identification of a gap in his teeth because no gap is visible in the picture.
Well, I guess putting it a different way, how did the show up, right, lead to an unreliable identification when the detail that she provided to the police was more than was in the photo?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly, and that's the whole point. The point is that whether or not the picture had some sort of corrosive effect on the identification, and it simply didn't, and the military judge never addressed that.
Which identifications are we talking about? Now, we have the identification through the photo.
Yes, Your Honor.
And where is the demonstration of the reliability of that? Which facts did the judge miss with respect to the question of the reliability of the photo, her identification of the photo?
The facts of that Ms. TB made positive, detailed identifications of the accused prior to being shown the photo. If they had shown her the photo and then said, okay, now describe for us what he looked like, you'd have a much different problem. But they obtained, on several occasions, at least two, specific detailed descriptions of the person before ever showing her a photo. So the photo could not have had an effect on her identification because the what was in her head.
No, I'm just talking about the identification of the photo itself.
Yes,
she said that's it. What demonstrates that was reliable? Excuse me. The fact that she made certain identifications beforehand, none of which showed the individual that was in the photo in terms of the display of the face.
But that factor, particularly in Manson versus Braithwaite, the fact that there was a description ahead of time goes towards whether or not the identification was based on her being shown the picture, or whether or not the identification was based on her using what she had in her memory and then linking it to the person who she showed in the photo. And she said it was both the clothing, the build, the facial features that she could see, the chin, the lips, the jaw. The fact that the sunglasses and the hat are two aspects of an identification that the military judge was very focused on. But
the judge can't rely on those, that it's unlawful for the judge to make the determination on that basis?
He can't, Your Honor, but he has to balance it against the other facts.
Okay.
I mean, it can't.
Understand.
I'm going to focus on these two facts. Either disregard the facts, talk about the facts, tell us why those facts aren't influential, but simply pretending they don't exist is not acceptable.
And in terms of the picture and its relationship to the in-court identification, what is in the record to show that there was any intervening identification in which she had the opportunity to view him in the same fashion that she saw him in the courtroom, other than the picture?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you say it again?
Was there any opportunity in which she made an identification of him before the courtroom, other than the identification of the picture, in terms of the way he looked in the courtroom and the facial display at that time?
No, Your Honor, there's nothing specific in the record. The identification of in the courtroom, she stated that she looked at him and she said, I can see his jaw, I can see his lips, I can see his facial features, and that's the same person. So that was where the in-court identification evidence was.
We'll have the opportunity, unless there are further questions, to briefly conclude.
Thank you. We could sum up, Your Honor, in saying that Mrs. TB positively and accurately identified appellant, and the military judge was clearly unreasonable in his determination that the identification was so unreliable that a trier of fact could not be trusted to evaluate the evidence and decide the issue. The concerns the military judge had are exactly the type that the Supreme Court has described as customary grist for the jury mill and should not have determined the issue of admissibility. The Army Corps properly exercises authority under Article 62 UCMJ in vacating the military judge's ruling, and this Court should affirm the Army Corps' decision.
Thank you, Counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honor, if I understand the government counsel's argument correctly, they are challenging certain findings of fact, for example, the military judge's findings regarding the level of attention that Ms. TB paid to the rider, and second, the lack of sufficient evidence regarding the likelihood of other individuals in the area matching Ms. TB's description. We would just point out that under this case, this court's law of the case doctrine, and we apologize we didn't cite it in our brief, but that The government did not challenge the finding of facts on appeal. The Army Corps found that it expressly adopted them, so we're all stuck.
Well, let's assume that they can. The law of the case doctrine is not a absolute prohibition, so let's assume that both the court below and this court can view the findings of fact and determine whether they are clearly erroneous. And the government's argument here is that they're clearly erroneous by omission. So why don't you go ahead and discuss that? That is, the government's argument that the findings of fact are clearly erroneous because they omit, that the judge's findings omit key facts that are in the record. That's what's one of the key points that's at issue right now. So don't worry about the law of the case. If my colleagues want to address that, that's fine. But let's assume that we're not going to apply that right now.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, we're not exactly clear what specific critical facts the military judge omitted here. The military judge at the motion for reconsideration did make additional findings of fact. Not all, but some of the additional findings.
Where is that in the record, please?
It's at various pages in the record, Your Honor. Just to go through it real quickly, regarding the shorts and the shirt at page 97, regarding the racing bike at page 108, regarding those are two areas, Your Honor. We stipulate
that he did find those facts, and they're not depicted in the written findings of facts. Please address not the government's argument that there are clearly erroneous facts, but address the government's argument that there is an abuse of discretion and unreasonable application of law to fact when critical facts are not addressed. Let's first stipulate that critical facts are not addressed. You don't have to agree to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's not your position. But let's say that is the case. Why is that or is that not an unreasonable application of law to fact to admit critical facts?
Well, Your Honor, we agree with the government, and I hope I'm not mischaracterizing their statements to the court, but that the judge is not required to do, extensive analysis. Is required to make findings of fact and conclusions of law. So we don't see that as an abuse of discretion based on everything else that he did in his opinion. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
I think the question is if they're critical facts and the judge doesn't address them in terms of applying the facts to the law, doesn't that then invalidate the judge's decision? Because those aspects, the application of law to facts, is missing something that's critical to the case. I'm not asking you to agree that that's
yes,
the proposition here, but that's, I understand, the government's proposition in this case, that there are critical facts in this case that the judge didn't address. And it wasn't simply a case of having it in his head. It's that it led to a deficiency in the analysis.
Yes, Your Honor. In the abstract, we agree with that proposition, that if there's critical facts missing from the judge's opinion, that would go towards whether or not he abused his discretion. We just don't believe that the military judge omitted critical facts. If I can respond briefly to the government's statement that the military judge and the Army Corps operated from the same facts, we disagree, Your Honors, for two principal reasons. First, there's just no way you can reasonably look at that sequence of events during that sole close encounter and extract 1 to 2 minutes. It's a fast-moving encounter. The military judge found, the Army Corps adopted, that Ms. TB was panicked, her heart was pounding, and she was focused on getting away, and that it lasted a few moments. Second, the Army Corps found that Ms. TB focused her full attention 5 times. The military judge found that Ms. TB was not paying particular attention to the rider at distances of 7 to 8 meters, 5 to 7 meters, and even during the close encounter, she was focused on getting away.
I have a question to ask you, counsel. How can the military judge goes through and describes the different times that this woman who is alone in a recreational park on a bike trail sees a individual at different times, right? How can the military judge say that the degree of attention on the rider was minimal? you know, not to refer to the fact that I'm a female, but if I'm walking along a bicycle path, every time I turn around, I see this individual popping up in different areas, I think my attention would be more than minimal.
Your Honor, a couple of ways the military judge arrived at that conclusion. One, Ms. Teepee's own testimony, that she generally doesn't pay particular attention to individuals as she's walking around the trail. Two, this was not a static situation. Ms. Teepee's moving, the rider is getting back on his bike and he's moving, and the military judge found that at those distances that we mentioned, that Ms. Teepee was not paying particular attention to the rider.
How do you square that with record pages 11 to 13? She said generally she doesn't pay close attention, but to get to Judge Ryan's question, if you look at pages 11 through 13, she keeps on seeing this biker pass her. She notices that he looks like he's, you know, going to the bathroom on the side twice.
Yes, sir. Well,
that's fairly close attention.
Yes, sir. This may stray a little bit into opportunity to view, but due to her nearsightedness alone, Ms. Teepee was not able to see the rider, and the military judge found this, Ms. Teepee was not able to see the rider or his face clearly during the first three encounters on the trail. And then at that final encounter, she could only see part of his face because it was concealed by his sunglasses and helmet nearby.
Well, would you agree that when you have a biker with a helmet and sunglasses on, that in part the vast majority of what you're going to notice is going to be other physical attributes, size, color, clothing, etc. And those were the things that she did get right?
Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, it's that, and I see that my time has expired. If
your time is long expired, yes, and you have the opportunity that you need to answer that question.
You have to stop immediately.
Yeah.
Sit down.
Thank you, Judge Efron. Your Honor,
you'll see how it works after October 1st.
Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, it's that if a witness, as in Ms. TB's shoes, sees a rider whose face is partially concealed by the helmet and sunglasses, is she going to naturally look to other areas of the rider's physique? And yes, Your Honor.
You may briefly conclude.
Your Honor, on some level, we recognize that this was a close call case for the military judge, and our view of this court's strict abuse of discretion standard is that in a close call case, the benefit of the doubt must go to the military judge. We ask that this court reverse the Army Court's decision, that this court leave the discretion where it should properly be with the military judge and send this case back to Germany. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess pending further order of the court.
The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.